Joining us on I'm Here with Jill Maria and myself is a successful TV film director and writer, David Strasser. And he's here today to talk about his passion and lots more. Welcome.
Hi, Christine. Hi, Jill. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm very excited for the opportunity. You know, we've crossed paths a couple times, and I love your enthusiasm for what you do. And I like being in conversation with enthusiastic people. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, David, we had you do a photo shoot in Vancouver with Ryan Jensen, and you met Christine there as well. And the photos that are going to come out on imherewithmag.com of you are really an interesting take. You know, there's a lot of behind the scenes photos of you directing Hallmark, Lifetime, up, you know, a whole bunch of projects you're doing right now. But we kind of wanted to do a photo for you, kind of like a gift that we could put together the article in a nice way as well. But, you know, we want the audience to see you as we see you. So we had you out in nature, and yeah, tell us about the photo shoot and how that went.
Yeah, it was great. First off, Ryan is just a talented individual, and I was really excited to meet him. I hadn't met him before. And, you know, he brought a lot of creative energy to the table for the photo shoot. You know, of course, it's Vancouver, so we were promised a clear day. So we had all these aspirations of these sort of, you know, backlit, sunny photos near the woods. Ended up being, you know, heavy downpour for the hour we were there. So we found some shelter in the, you know, the big trees of BC. And you know what? It created for some like dynamic landscape. And it just felt there was a quiet when you're in the woods. And especially like during these times of COVID, you know, we're all kind of stuck at home, but it's not quiet time. It's a weird time, right? Because our minds are really active and there's stress involved, and you know, we're dealing with the sort of the different personalities within ourselves sort of competing for your own attention within yourself. And I just found getting out in nature and having Ryan direct me, which was great. And I said to him, listen, I work in a film and it's a very different medium than photography. I'm quite passionate about photography myself, but I learned very early on that directing in photography is a very specific skill set, and it's actually quite a different skill set than directing, you know, for film-based media, you know, and the communication style is different. And it was just nice to have Ryan there to sort of guide me and to make me feel comfortable and to get the best out of me. I tend to only like to smile, you know, and he kind of forced me to put on some different
look.
Yeah, aspects of my personality, and it was a really good time. I really enjoyed it, and we stayed dry, which was amazing because we were literally out in quite a rainy day, but yes. BC nature provides cover.
Wow, and Christine, you were a part of that as well. They're on our social media. I just thought, how special would it be to have a new photo shoot for the new year? You know, I like to do that for people as a media artist as well, to create the content for you guys, just because it's new. You know, everybody loves new. And speaking of new, David, you have been pumping out with the last 2 years, project after project, for Lifetime, for Hallmark, for Up TV. You've been working on a documentary just last night and then doing the interview today. You probably got no sleep. So let's talk about your many, many projects you've been working on. So I'll list a few for the audience, which they already, a lot of the Kelowna industry thinks you're a hero, which you are, for bringing projects to the town, giving opportunities to people like Chanel Connell, and many more. So we've got The Dating List, Just for the Summer, Love is a Piece of Cake, that just aired recently, again, Love Second Chance, A Wedding to Remember, and Love at Cedar Creek. So we've got The Glenbrook Christmas, which I watched recently and I really loved it, with Autumn Reeser, huge fan from the OC. So let's talk about some of the hallmarks that you've been working on.
Yeah, I mean, the most I'll start with the most recent, and then I'll talk a little bit about kind of how I've become a romance and a romantic comedy director. And, you know, if you would ask me 3 years ago, would I see myself directing full time in romance? And I probably would have laughed at you and told you we're about to enter an alternate reality. But we seem to be in an alternate reality. And I find directing romance to be a really uplifting part of my career. And I find a tremendous amount of meaning in it that I didn't think, you know, my old self wouldn't have thought that I could find.
Well, 'cause you're a man, you know, right? So you think of it's a genre. I think people don't really realize there's a formula, which you've nailed it.
Emotional thank you.
Music comes in right at the time. I feel it. So continue.
At the end of the day, I'm surrounded by really strong teams. You know, speaking of music, for example, on my most recent endeavor, Glenbrook Christmas, which you saw, I worked with the composer, Graham Coleman. And Graham, you know, he created some magical moments that weren't necessarily there without his contribution. And I've just found that along the way that filmmaking truly is a collaborative art form. And from everything from the visuals to the performances to the way the camera moves to the music that gets put together at the end, contribution of composers and colorists, you end up with just such an incredibly talented team. And I've started to learn, and I guess, you know, as I get my 10,000 hours of time put into the art of directing, I'm realizing that the role of the director, while it is the role of a leader and at sometimes a dictator, other times a member of a democracy, but ultimately it's the role of a collaborator. I'm getting sidetracked a little bit, but it is really the spirit of collaboration that makes filmmaking meaningful to me. Now, talking about Glenbrook Christmas, there were so many incredibly talented people. Glenbrook Christmas is the highest budget Hallmark rom-com that I've directed to date. So I had more resources available to me, and that meant I got to work with actors that, you know, really have established themselves as leaders in this genre. Autumn Reeser, Antonio Cupo, to name the two leads, but some of the supporting cast we had were absolutely phenomenal too. Antonio and Autumn though, honestly, just I've had amazing experiences with all of the leads I've had in my films. And each one brings like a really unique energy to what they do. Autumn and Antonio, because they've worked together, I think this is the fourth film they've starred in together, the third Hallmark movie they've starred in together. And they just have a second hand and a playfulness. Autumn is sort of a true professional. Her preparation, her sort of insight and intellect into her characters is really unrivaled. She's at the top of her game. She knows what she's doing, and she's just marvelous to work with. Antonio is very similar, but also very different. Antonio brings a lot of sort of raw energy and likes to bring sort of a personality and a humor to his performances and to how he goes about working with Autumn. And they're kind of, it's like a beautiful yin and yang balance between the two of them, because, you know, she's got, you know, the notes on the side of her script and the highlighter, and Antonio is very much more charismatic with how he approaches it. And what ends up happening is you get this sort of natural dynamism between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And that was a beautiful experience for me to, I've never worked with actors that have had such a long running history with one another. And I can see why directors like to work with the same actors, because the relationship takes on, you know, a texture over time that you don't get on a one-by-one basis.
The beautiful relationship that is formed in film, and that's why I'm a huge film buff, as people know. So David, your first step into the film industry, just before, you know, getting into directing, you know, it's a journey to get there. And it's great to share that story with people, because then they get influenced and inspired. And, you know, it's a long road. So people have to know it takes time. So let's share a little bit the beginning. Killer Body was very different than any of the other projects you've done. Really cool, beautiful women in it. I think when I watched it, I was like, girl, I could get there. I'm getting all crazy and want to look like somebody. Like, yeah, I can get there. I had to check myself after that. But
yeah, I think we all do. Lindsay Maxwell brought the villainess to life in such a way. There were times where I needed to remind myself that Lindsay and her character Liz were two different people, because when I'd say cut, Lindsay occupied this sort of woman on the edge of sanity so well that I couldn't tell the difference between the person and the character. And, you know, when we went out for wrap drinks, this is pre-COVID, obviously, a couple of years ago, I remember sitting with Lindsay and having a conversation with her and just realizing, oh, wow, you are not the mad woman from the film. You are actually, you know, you're actually this well-rounded, caring, insightful individual, not someone who is, you know, in pursuit of these sort of insane ideals.
Well, I think with that project, not saying I connected with it, you guys.
A little. We all do on some level, right? Especially these times.
Because of social media, you know, you never feel good enough. And sometimes you just feel like you wish you could be somebody else. And if you look like somebody else, then maybe you'd have a different life. Or, you know, you just, you know, you see what's on TV and even Hallmark, you know, like sometimes I was really happy that Antonio was in the Glenbrook, because, you know, for people like me who are, you know, foreign, I'm Romanian, you don't see people who look like you as much as you'd like on TV as a norm. It's more like a token person. I know there's been a whole thing in the industry with all that. We won't get into that though, but it was nice to see somebody who was foreign, you know, a leading man. And I connected with that role as well. So let's talk about how you got into film even. Like, there must have been a story about when you were young and you, you know, wanted to get into film.
Oh, goodness. I'm going to try and tell this story in as short a form as possible so that your audience can digest it. So, yeah, I'm not the classic story where I was the, you know, the 8-year-old kid that picked up the camcorder and, you know, chased my sisters around trying to tell a story. You know, I as well come from an immigrant family. I was born in Bolivia, moved to Canada when I was a young boy. English was my second language in those days. Now it's, I'm afraid to say my Spanish is, my comprehension's not bad, but my ability to speak it isn't fantastic anymore. Yeah. You know, we came to Canada for a new beginning as a family. And so we didn't have a lot of means when we were young. And there comes struggles with being a poor immigrant family. And over time, my family did become successful and provide me a lot of opportunity. But my formative years were a bit of a struggle as a family. And, you know, I ended up finding some refuge in movies and television, and they spoke to me. I was a real child of the 80s and then a teenager of the 90s. So I came up through the time of Oliver Stone and Quentin Tarantino and the beginning of Wes Anderson. You know, and there's, of course, the great auteurs like Scorsese and whatnot, but the new wave, I think they called it the second wave of American independent cinema. So Darren Aronofsky, Quentin Tarantino, Wes Anderson, who were trying to relate to audiences on a very primitive level, I thought, and they were telling stories in a way that were not polished. They were using editing styles and, you know, using violence and sexuality, and they were breaking the norms. And it was obviously very stimulating to me as a teenager. And that's really when the hooks got into me. You know, I have a very distinct memory in my first year of university when Requiem for a Dream was playing primarily in the independent film theater circuit, the art house theaters, which are, you know, disappearing more and more. There's a climax montage in that movie where every main character you've been following, things go just catastrophically wrong for them in this very high energy montage. And I had my hands on my knees sitting in the theater, and the theater was full. It was completely, you know, dark except for the light from the screen. And a woman in the audience went into hysterics. And they had to bring up the house lights. They had to stop the movie. They had to get medical attention to her because it was so The emotional response to what was going on was just so significant, and it obviously spoke directly to an experience in her life, when I'm not sure what that experience was, but she couldn't contain the reaction. And for me, I saw that, and then I lifted my hands off my knees, and I had sweated my palm prints through my jeans. And I just realized how visceral an experience I was having. And I had this, like, I guess a Damascene moment there, where I just thought, I want to do this. I want the opportunity to make people feel how I'm feeling right now. And, you know, and I kind of became a student of cinema at that point, where I started to think, well, there's something going on here, right? Because I loved reading literature, and I read novels all through university. But film was able to get inside of me in a way that other mediums of art weren't able to. You know, and that wasn't necessarily my first foray into the arts. All through high school and junior high, I was very engaged in theater. I directed my first two plays in high school. And so the idea of being a director and speaking through that sort of theatrical experience, that had always been a part of me. I was a drama kid, but also an athlete. So I sort of lived in that sort of, in this weird kind of duplicitous binary world within myself, where I was like an art kid, but I was also a jock. And, you know, back in the 90s, cool kid. you were still split, right? Like, and so I had two circles of friends, and I kind of had to be one way in one world and another way in another world. And that was kind of being, you know, they call it toxic masculinity now. They didn't have a word for it back then. You know, it was just part of growing up a male in Western society. But now that we have this new vocabulary to talk about experiences that we had growing up, I was stuck in this world where there's all these toxic expectations put upon males, especially if they're athletes, and these sorts of things. And I constantly found myself trying to manage those expectations, because it wasn't the core of who I was, but I still had to, like, manage the relationships within those worlds. And so, you know, I grew up in Alberta to boot, which has its own sort of characteristics. So as soon as I graduated, I was able to escape to BC, where I started finding like-minded people, much more liberal ideas, much more liberal philosophies about personhood and humanistic values that I couldn't quite access in my upbringing, but I found out here in BC. Okay, but let's fast forward. So, you know, I went to university, I studied psychology and philosophy. I eventually went to law school. I graduated with a degree in law, all the time continuing as an athlete. I had the opportunity to train and compete at a world-class level as a rower, and was invited to train with the Canadian National Training Center in Victoria. And I graduated from law school, and I went off to continue pursuing sports. During that time, I met a beautiful human being named Jason Benab. Him and I ended up becoming business partners together. And I went off and had a whole other life. You know, I found a woman who would become the mother of my two children, my business partner, and we built up a career on Vancouver Island in real estate. And it was a great time, in that it was this sort of never-ending challenge to grow. But the further we got along in this path of success, in terms of, you know, the rewards of running a successful business, of having the respect and recognition of our peers, I found that there was a big void opening up within myself, and that the things I was doing weren't fulfilling that sort of spiritual need I had to create. And, you know, some life events happened around that same time, when I was feeling this sort of existential chaos, is the best word I can describe it. You know, and I lost two family members within a very short period of time. And so it forced me to take a break. And I went off down back to South America to help my mother and sister with the events that were going on in our lives. And it was nothing short of tragedy. We lost my 18-year-old nephew, and then shortly thereafter lost my father. And I realized, and again, you know, this is a cliche thing, but when it really impacts you, you can't escape it. And that is the fact that your time on this planet is short, and you have to honor the gift of life. So I really felt that I wasn't honoring my gift. And in order to honor the death of my close family members, I needed to get back in tune with my spiritual self and be okay with letting go of the recognition of my peers, the financial success, these sort of these building blocks of life that you're told are supposed to fulfill you and they don't. And so I had this opportunity to go away, to step outside of my life. And it was during that time when I decided that there's no time like the present, that there was not going to be some sort of a golden opportunity. You know, I kind of always thought in my head at some point in the future when I had enough of this or enough of that, some opportunity would come out of the cosmos and it would say, okay, now go be creative. Mm-hmm. And then I just, you know, this sense of agency like welled up inside of me. It's like, no, it's not going to come from outside. It only comes from within. So you either choose to do what you want to do, or you continue to live this sort of life where this void gets bigger and bigger. So you know what, in a matter of a couple of months, I turned over the reins of my business to my business partner. I told him I wasn't going to come back. He was a great person at the time. His name was Mark Salter. He'd taken on the role with me, and he wished me well, and he worked with me on the transition. And I went off to film school, and this was in 2014. You know, I was 36 years old, so very late. You know, my peers in film school were in their 20s. Or 35, 36 years old at the time. And, you know, I did the whole early midlife thing and I was okay with it. It because it came very deep from within. And it was just the need to, you know, honor my dreams. So I went to film school with a very practical mindset, you know, because I had had, previous education, a lot of practical life experience. You know, film school was a means to an end, which sort of gave me a different point of view than most people that I think go to film school, who come more starry-eyed with sort of like more global ambitions, but less of a direct path to get from A to B. I really wanted to figure out how to use the tools I learned in film school to get me into a career in film. And so while I was there, I met a couple of incredible people. One person in particular, his name was Arshia Navabi, Iranian Canadian, also an immigrant. And he was very mindful of producing. And he said to me, hey, you know, instead of following the regular pathway of producing a short film while you're in film school, would you be interested in trying to produce a feature film? And if so, do you have any ideas? And him and I had gravitated together because of a lot of common grounds. He had lost his mother. I had lost my father. We're both immigrants. We're both people who were very determined to be pragmatic about our film life. And I said, as a matter of fact, I do have a script. And the film at the time was called Raw. And it was about raw milk. It was a coming of age story. And, you know, most people who hear, oh, you want to make a film about raw milk distribution and how it's basically treated like a crime in Canada. And the laws for the distribution of raw milk are similar to the laws for, let's say, dealing cocaine or distributing cocaine. You know, and I always thought these sorts of things were crazy. And they always tell you in film school to write what you know. Well, I was a passionate food sovereigntist, so I was, you know, very much into knowing what your food sources were, understanding a lot about how our model in Canada and the world works to what we eat and how everything had become so industrial and how there were so many chemical additives in our food. And I really wanted to understand at what point did as a society, did we give up control to food? And this was my script that allowed me to understand how something is, you know, pure and is unfiltered and unprocessed as raw milk could be treated like, you know, a synthetic substance like crystal methamphetamine, right? And so that's where that script came from. And Arshia said, great, let's make it. And you know, this partnership enabled me to make a movie. And we made a movie against all odds with almost no money. And that movie became the foundation of my film career. You know, and eventually that film got a distributor, IndieCan Entertainment, a man who's been a huge supporter of my career named Avi Fettergreen got behind the project. he distributed it worldwide, and you know, now it's on Amazon Prime. It plays on Canadian cable networks, you know, and it is very much a first film. It's a film I'm incredibly proud of, and it's my first chance at telling a story that was meaningful to me. So that film essentially laid the foundation for me to get my first opportunity to be interviewed by a television production company, and that was a local company, a Canadian company called Real One Entertainment. And a man there named Richard Greenhall called me in and said, "Hey, I had a chance to watch your film Delinquent. I know your cinematographer, want my best friend named Rivo Cruz." And he says, "Rivo says, we should take a chance on you. And so I'm going to bring you in to meet the vice president of production, a man named Gilles Laplante. And if Gilles feels that he's willing to invest in you, we're going to make a movie." So I went in for that movie. And again, a constellation of people, my best friend, someone willing to take a risk on me, a vice president of production who believed in me. Well, they gave me my first baby and they said, "Here you go." And they sent me off to direct Killer Body. And it was just an amazing experience. More than anything, it was an experience of growth, because directing independent work is very different, because you're surrounded often with crew that invests in your vision. And it's not a job to them, you know, like in the independent filmmaking world, it really is a group of collaborators, and everyone who's helping you, whether it's your second assistant clapping the slate or a lamp operator, you know, when they're not on your film set, you're on their film set, when they're directing, when they're DPing, when they're writing, you know, there's this kind of exchange of creative talent. And I came into the film industry with that attitude. Okay, I'm a writer director. But I'm also a camera operator, a focus puller, and a second assistant. You know, and when I need to on my documentary projects, I'll be the DP. You know, you'll be the PA if you have to be. You'll be the one who goes and gets the coffee. And that's a really important mindset that I bring into my professional career too, right? Everyone on my sets is talented, and everyone has their creative role above and beyond their technical role. And I believe in that. Now that doesn't mean I'm running a democratic film set. You know, I come to the project, it's my vision, and I'm going to execute my vision, and I'm going to do it collaboratively. Right. But when you bring your vision to the table on your project, I will be there to support you, as a technician, if you invite me to. And so sort of that's how I got into the business, and that's kind of laid the foundation, which I really worked hard to maintain with respect to my an attitude of gratitude and an attitude of servitude.
Wow, David, you're incredible.
David, how do you balance your lifestyle? Like, you're so busy, so successful, and, you know, tell us, how do you maintain your stamina?
Oh, you know what?
Ask his wife.
Yeah. Well, I have an incredibly patient partner. She's in my corner all the time. She works on a lot of my projects. You know, I'm about to direct a television movie that she wrote, that was acquired by Real One. You know, and the documentary shoot I was on yesterday was not my shoot. I was there as a cinematographer. It was her project. And so, you know, again, it's the give and take, and it works even within my own household. And it applies to my children too. My children are both YouTubers, 10 and 12.
Get them to work. Yeah. All those numbers will make money.
Yeah. Well, more importantly, I want them to feel like they have a medium to express themselves. And they both found that in their channels. And they're very esoteric, the two of them. So I love watching them thrive. And I love watching them gain their confidence in that regard. But back to your question, Christine, you know, I'm honestly an absolute hot mess. When this camera turns off and when people don't see me on set, I am no different than anybody else. I am on the borderline of managing burnout all the time. I bring stress home, you know, but I make some lifestyle choices that allow me to stay on the edge longer, right? Like I'm very conscientious with drinking and recreational drug use. I'm very, very conscientious about sleep. And again, I'm an open book. Wow. I and I really don't judge any lifestyle, I have one rule, you know, if the match that you're burning is going to burn me, then it's a problem. Outside of that, you know, it's very much, you do what makes your life work. But in terms of that, you know, I just try and keep everything in air. I try and exercise regularly. I go through periods where that's very successful and other periods where it's like a real struggle, you know, and I try and do all of the things that you're supposed to do to maintain a busy, healthy life. And, you know, you try things on different diets, different exercise routines, different sleep cycles. You know, for the longest time, the most creative time I would have was from, you know, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And then I would sleep. And this was when I was, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years younger. But I realized when it comes to being a working professional, that while it serves the creative for me, it doesn't serve the professional life. So I had to kind of recondition myself to get the best hours out of myself in the morning, to try and be in bed between 10 and 11 p.m., to try and be up. You know, especially once we hit spring, I can't really sleep in. So I'm usually up around 5:15 in the morning, and I'm not very productive in the first hour and a half that I'm awake. You know, I've learned some things. I've had so many opportunities. You know, I was invited to the TIFF Filmmaker Lab, the Banff Story Hive Fellowship, the Berlin Alley Jets program. And I've had so much opportunity for mentorship by quite literally the world's best creative minds. You know, I've been to master classes with some of my, you know, people that I never thought I'd be able to sit in the same room with. So these opportunities have opened up huge doors, but more importantly, I've heard their story from them and been able to ask questions. And the reality is everyone is dealing with the same struggles, right? You know, whether you're an Academy Award winning director, writer, you still wake up in the morning and have to manage your life. You still have to motivate yourself. There's no different. And the difference is, and again, you know, if you look at that sort of Tony Robbins mantra, it comes down to simply the plan, right? It's not so much motive. Is your plan, can it be executed? And that's kind of how I try and approach my life. Do I have a plan that I can actually execute? Are my goals achievable? You know, we can have our aspirations, our driving principles, you know, the big ideas about who we are and what we want to be in the world, but you have to have like the short-term goals. And, you know, back when I was younger, my goals were consistently unachievable. And so you don't even make small progress. You know, sometimes my goal is as easy as, hey, you need to return that Amazon order today, right? Before you run out of time to return it. You know, I find that if you create like a baby step plan to how you approach everything, you will actually achieve the goal. And so that's, again, a very long answer to the question, but that's kind of, you know, I'm constantly managing, you know, burnout, stress, creative frustration. You know, I have all the same voices in my head that tell you, you can't do it. You're not good enough. You know, you struggle with imposter syndrome, but at the end of the day, you know, the people who are around me believe in me and they lift me up. And then in exchange for them lifting me up, I honor that by honoring my commitments and seeing things through the finish line, you know, delivering a movie on budget and on time that the distributors will be happy with. And Reel One Entertainment in particular taught me quite a few lessons. I mean, they are a lower budget production company and they have an acquisition model. So a lot of their movies aren't sold when I make them. So they make a particular genre of film, whether it be a thriller or romantic comedy. And then when it's finished, Hallmark or Up TV or the W Network or, you know, Lifetime will buy the film. And so when they ask you to come direct one of their movies, they're taking a risk with you. And so again, I have to honor that risk. Right. Mm-hmm. I need to not turn this into an auteur work. I need to turn it into something that fulfills their objectives. And so that's, you know, that's the heart of kind of how you work in this business, right? You have to honor the people who are willing to get behind you.
Yes. Wonderful.
I feel like I just went to a master class.
Yes.
Yeah, and again, any ideas that I'm borrowing from my mentors and colleagues, I give you credit for. I just may not remember who you are and when you told me.
We will remind you, David. We will remind you.
Yes.
Thank goodness. Thank you so much for your time today. You have just been like an educator to us and said some really good things. I hope the audience enjoys the podcast that we'll put this to as well, and the show, Christine and Jill Maria. David, we're going to watch all your projects and bug you way more to promote all of them.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Jill and Christina. Christine, sorry. Thank you very much, Jill and Christine. Yeah, it's a real honor. And I thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And, you know, it's 2021. 2020 was a challenging year. You know, the film industry, it managed to get back on its legs and come back with quite a bit of force. You know, there's still a lot of uncertainty in the air. And I just, you know, my message to your viewers is, you know, don't let quarantine hold you down. You know, find those little moments to cherish, and you know, have faith in your dreams, and create a plan to get there. You know, and I hope to see you guys somewhere along the way.
Oh yes, yes. There'll be times, David.
Yes,
awesome.
Thank you guys so much. It was too fun, you guys.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.